One of the changes that analysis provided me with has been awareness about how similar we all are. Of course, with the due differences. But for me, an analyst is, before all, a person who had the worth opportunity to realize how we all, the human beings, are very similar and how we can familiarize with ourselves and with the others thanks to these similarities and continuities. Like the majority, but I would say like all my colleagues, I approached the psychoanalysis and I asked for analysis when I was a young doctor in order to be helped. And this is what is absolutely and seriously common to all the analysts. Analysts are people who are more aware and more experienced to ask for help than other people, because they had the opportunity to be helped by a good treatment and to have the opportunity to integrate better.
Welcome to the Psychoanalysis On and Off the Couch podcast. For the past few years, we've been speaking with analysts from around the world who've been applying their analytic way of thinking, not only to their offices, but also off the couch, in venues external to their consulting rooms. We've spoken to analysts who work in hospitals, in prisons, in community health centers, in refugee clinics, just to name a few. We've also detoured, of course, during COVID. We've spoken with analysts again from around the world to learn from our communities how they, their patients, and the analytic community in general have been dealing with this crisis. And hopefully, the worst is over, and we can return to our main focus. We can return to speaking to analysts who are bringing their skills to people who otherwise would never see the inside of an analyst's office. In addition to that, we're speaking with the elders of our field, people who have been practicing this craft for 40 and 50, sometimes longer years, to learn from them what they have to teach us, not only about this piece of history that we're all living through, but their reflections on our field. Please visit us at our website, ipaoffthecouch.org, where you can leave a comment, where you can subscribe. I hope you find these conversations thoughtful and meaningful, and I appreciate your listening. Thank you. Welcome to today's podcast. I'm Harvey Schwartz, and my guest today is Dr. Stefano Bolognini. Our conversation today revolves around a chapter he wrote entitled New Forms of Psychopathology in a Changing World in a book called Psychoanalysis at the Crossroads. And to be succinct, Dr. Bolognini feels that today's patients are different than yesterday's patients, in the particular way that patients bring narcissistic defenses to the analytic engagement. And he feels that this is due to a suspiciousness of dependency, an awkwardness with mutuality. And he discusses what he presumes to be the developmental antecedents that bring the patients and their treatments to this state of being right now. We discuss the implications for the way the treatment is conducted, some of the new techniques that have to be brought forward, the importance of countertransference, and most importantly for me is what he shares with us when he closes our conversation, and I ask him about himself and what brings him to be an analyst and the kind of analyst he is. He says that for him, the essence of being an analyst is to understand what it means to ask for help. And it
was so simple, so profound, so clear. And I thought, in the face of theoretical arguments these days, the ability to boil down our work to being clinicians who are here to help people, his metaphor is providing an umbrella, that characterized who he was to me in this conversation and the nature of our conversation. He is, in terms of his official characteristics, he is a psychiatrist and a training and supervising analyst of the Italian Psychoanalytic Society, where he served as president. He was also an IPA board member, and he was, famously, an IPA president from 2013 to 2017. He's a member of the European Editorial Board. He was a member of the European Editorial Board of the International Journal of Psychoanalysis, a founder of the IPA Interregional Encyclopedic Dictionary of Psychoanalysis. He's published very widely, two books, well-reviewed books. One is called Secret Passages, The Theory and Technique of the Intrapsychic Relations, and also Vital Flows Between Self and Non-Self. There are a number of his important papers that are listed in the recommended readings, as well as a link to the Sigmund Freud lecture that he gave at the Freud Museum, Freud Foundation. I found this to be a very important and very satisfying conversation, and I hope you enjoy it as well. Here's my conversation with Dr. Stefano Bolognini. Stefano, welcome to the podcast. I'm so glad to have you here. Stefano, you've written a chapter called New Forms of Psychopathology in a Changing World, A Challenge for Psychoanalysis in the 21st Century. This is in a book entitled Psychoanalysis at the Crossroads, which is edited by Fred Bush. And the thesis of your chapter, which I'd like us to flesh out today, is the idea that patients are different nowadays, and that they are different, you feel, in a very particular fashion. They are different in the sense that there is a reluctance, conscious and otherwise, to depend upon somebody. And you spend time in this chapter describing what you mean by that, postulating some of the backgrounds, the developmental aspects that contribute to that, and also considering some of the challenges that psychoanalysts have about how we technically engage with people who present with this way of thinking. And before I ask you to start us off with describing that, I want to read a couple of excerpts from the chapter. First of all, when we talk about patients being different today, immediately the question comes up, is it patients who are different or is it analysts who are different? And you take this up on practically the first page, and you say the following, quote, "The slogan was, the patients haven't changed, it's the analysts who've changed." In the complacent and insinuating manner with which this perspective was loftily inculcated by the speaker, very often produced immediate assent in the listener for fear of being included in the category of second-class analysts, with the culpable tendency towards a decline in quality. Now, I want to start us off with that to, number one, to introduce the listener to how beautifully you write, but also because the question of the quality of the analyst is, one of those questions that we're going to have to put aside because it's so full of innuendo and defensiveness, just as you describe. And we're gonna focus on the issue of the patients. And you write to introduce it. You write the following quote: "Many patients today, in fact, reject the idea of depending openly and intensively on someone." And you go on to say, "In an ideal line connecting the subject, the analyst, and to the object, the analyst, the investment center of gravity seems in many cases today to remain preemptively and implicitly shifted toward the subject itself, which is careful not to put its own libidinal and narcissistic capital in the hands of the other, at least until the other has, with time, overcome the barriers of mistrust and self-protection that we presume were built up early on. Close quote. Stefano, tell us about this issue of dependency and how you understand its presence nowadays.
Yes, this observation became interesting and intriguing for me, both because of the clinical work and reports by colleagues here in our country, in Italy. But then, when I had the opportunity to travel all over the world for the IPA during my presidency, I had the opportunity to collect a lot of reports about this phenomenon, which in short seems to present a different approach by many, many patients to the psychoanalytic consultation in order to plan for and help. And the general observation by many colleagues was that a sort of magic expectation that the analytic treatment would have been possibly short, low frequency, economical, cheap, I mean, and possibly also delightful, with a very low level of pain or engagement or work, in short, was a quite common data in the difficulty that many patients opposed to starting a treatment, to planning and starting a treatment. What is also relevant is that very frequently this opposition or resistance or reluctance appeared also in patients who had no economical problems. Economical problems can be very important, of course, but in several cases they are not the main issue. The main issue appeared to be the difficulty to accept a dependency, an interdepending relationship each other with the obligation of a setting and a contract, which looked sometimes like a danger for the patient, subjectively experienced as such, sometimes like a sort of injury, of an offense, an outrage that the person could not accept with a sense of fierce reaction to that. So I started asking the colleagues about this increasing issue that in the past was less present, and the resistance appeared in many cases after the start of the treatment. Today it's more difficult to propose a high frequency treatment to the patients, due sometimes to reality problems that cannot be denied, but in many cases to the reason I presented now, just now, which is something absolutely connected to the object relation of the subject.
Let me ask you a question about that. And tell me if I'm understanding your point right. One way to think of the initial phase of analysis is that it consists of helping the patient recognize their reluctances to engage with the analyst, to acknowledge that the analyst is someone important to them, important both in current space and also important as it represents their whole early history. The phrase back in the day that was used is that the initial phase of analysis entails addressing resistances to the transference. And those resistances back in the day were of a traditional sort, let's say, obviously with great individual variation, but in the neurotic category of dealing with defenses of intellectualization or hyper-emotionality, those kinds of typical defenses, would it not be true to say that our task is the same in terms of the substance, which is to address these resistances to the transference, but now we are faced with narcissistic defenses, such as omnipotence and entitlement, or somatization and hypochondriasis, sometimes drug abuse, but that the task of bringing to the patient's attention their reluctances to recognize how important the analyst is becoming to them, that part hasn't changed.
Yes, what I'm referring to is, above all, the difficulty to start the treatment. Then resistances are more or less the same than in the past. The difficulty today is to have an acceptance by the patient to start the treatment with the due frequency. And I think that when in the past the patients accepted the setting and the contract, this didn't avoid at all that immediately the resistances in the transference appeared. Mm-hmm. But inside the frame of an accepted therapeutic analytical relationship. It's hard today to have that acceptance. If you allow me a metaphor, there is a contemporary phenomenon, which in Europe is very easy to observe. That is that the new generations don't want to utilize the umbrella when it rains. And this elementary detail reveals that they don't want to feel covered, protected, or to have an heavy object to bring with them. Like if this kind of protective metaphor of the superego that could correspond to the analytic setting and the presence of the object analyst is excluded in principle, because it would offend the autonomy, the ideal no-need condition that many young people would like to keep, to maintain. When the patient listens to the analyst proposing an high-frequency treatment, there is a first barrier to overcome. And I remember many patients who started later a treatment, as we consider an analysis to be, only after having approached cautiously, and I would say also mistrustfully, the relation with the analyst. I think the best metaphor is in the novel by Saint-Exupéry, The Little Prince, when the fox teaches the prince, the human being, to tolerate her reluctance for a while, for due time, and to allow her, the fox, to approach the prince a bit more day by day. It is what, in fact, happens today with many patients.
Yeah. Your metaphor of the protective umbrella is, of course, lovely. The challenge is for those patients who don't bring that history and set of assumptions to what an object relation means, so often they were not raised well protected by umbrellas, and that's part of the challenge. I have another question for you. The notion that patients are different today, what if we turn that around a little bit and consider that, are patients different today, or are we able to better understand patients today because we have more multidimensional theory? We have access to our countertransference, both as a way to preserve ourselves and also a way to tune in to the patient's experience. And we know how to utilize group processes, including group supervisions and individual supervisions. All these technical armamentarium, all these technical strengthening devices we have to enable us to go deeper in our experience of another human being. Perhaps had we had that 50 plus years ago, we would have found patients then as they are now, but because of our limitations as a profession, we weren't able to offer them the depth that we can now offer people. That's why they appear different. What do you think?
I think both are real. On one hand, we have a lot of tools, theoretical, technical, clinical tools, probably the majority of psychoanalysts hadn't in the past. It's the sum of achievements that psychoanalysis in 120 years was able to build up. And I think that the many observations, the many clinical and theoretical models, the experience, the exchange of experiences among analysts, today we can communicate each other from different countries and different regions. Mm. This opens our minds. All these new possibilities have enriched our armamentarium, as you said. Mm-hmm. But on the other hand, it is also true that the children and today, and for many years, are growing up in a different way than in the past. They have a lot of devices that allow them or force them to be in contact each other, or not to be in contact. There is a very different organization of the families, as I reported in my chapter in the book. Mm-hmm. The families divide and split much easier. There is less trust in the continuity of the setting where the children are growing up. And also the caregivers that in the past were usually or the grandparents or a very long-term nanny or someone of the broad family, mm-hmm. are now turning over in a way that allows or teaches the children not to attach too much in order to preserve themselves from disappointments, losses, and pains. Furthermore, there are television, there are many internet and mobile devices and so on, and there is less possibility than in the past, mainly in the big towns, to share with other children in a very spontaneous way the camps, the gardens, the courtyards, those common spaces that in the past, when I speak about past, I'm speaking before and after the Second World War, when people had a different environmental situation. Today, the children are frequently quite lonely, and they utilize many devices for passing their time.
And you write about how this appears in the office. You say the following: paradoxically, the preliminary narcissistic stance of not wanting to depend on the analyst and on analysis is actually flaunted with a certain pride in the initial consultations by many potential patients, as if they felt that just by being there, they were halfway to regaining their health. The temporary and maturational dependency on analysis is not only feared, but also egosyntonically disdained with a full feeling of self-legitimation, the subject being evidently unaware of her own profound needs and the problematic state of her relationship with the object. Close quote. And that's exactly what you just linked to the developmental struggles you outlined.
Yes.
One of the shorthands that I use when I encounter that, and this is something we all more or less do, it's that when one turns a symptom into a virtue.
Yeah.
The symptom in this case being, I won't depend upon you, and I'm not going to recognize that that elicits conflict in me and longing in me. I'm just going to say it makes me virtuous and better than those who do depend upon people.
Exactly. This is something that in the past was less important because people looked for help and possibly presented resistances immediately against the authority, against the umbrella, against all the representations of the power. But after having started a protective and inclusive therapy with the analyst.
Now, you also write about the challenge to analysts and the field. How do we engage with these individuals? Well, first of all, we recognize some of the things you say and that the initial phase of analysis is now different. But you also speak of there being advantages. You write, you write two things. First, about, again, the role of countertransference. You write, analysts are tested by constant experiences of the primary levels of relationship and with very powerful regressive transferences, which engage the therapist countertransferentially at very deep levels, sometimes with weighty consequences for the everyday psychic metabolism of the analyst himself. I'm going to ask you about that. But then you go on to talk about there are two positives you feel. Quote, one is increased technical competence fostered by a now extensive and well-established analytic literature on the subject, and especially by the sometimes enthusiastic contributions of great teachers. And you also say the other positive has been a different political stance in some countries about the social function of psychoanalysis with a much wider remit than in the past, aimed at caring for socio-cultural clusters of the population who used to be excluded for diagnostic or economic reasons. Start us off with the countertransference changes that we are now faced with.
Yes. For sure, the psychoanalytic literature has developed in a wonderful way by highlighting these dimensions, levels, functions in the human relation generally and in the analytic relations particularly. But I think that the main factor is another one, and it has been the way the analytic work allowed the analysts as patients in their training to experience deeper levels of self-exploration and mutual recognition of what happens between two human beings when they become so involved in their relationship. In short, I think that the analytic work has improved. And this is not strange, because more than one century of analytic practice made the analysts more aware, more able. Also, the length of the analytic analysis of the analysts and the depth of it was the factor that allowed and allows analysts to recognize, to resonate to the involvement and the deep experience of the patients. I remember a sentence by Greenson, who wrote very simply that basically each analyst has to know, and usually knows, that more or less the same intra-psychic and inter-psychic passages the patient experiences have been passed through by the analyst also when he was a patient, when he was a child, when he was an adolescent, and maybe also much earlier. And I think that we are now in condition to resonate to a multifaceted experience that the patients go through.
You're adding a new point, which, tell me if I have it right, that is that one of the things that allows us to more deeply engage with our patients is that we ourselves, you feel, have had deeper analytic experiences.
Yes.
Deeper in terms of the intimacy, and also deeper in terms of the length.
Yes.
And that's what enables the work to be more profound today.
Yes. We all experienced our narcissistic defenses, our fears, our fantasies and phantoms. And I omitted that the sentence by Greenson that came to my mind now,
yeah,
is that each analyst had to recognize that what is in the patients, hopefully at a different level of intensity, more or less is also part of the common nature of all of us. It varies for quantity, for connections or disconnections, more split or more integrated. But when we say we are human beings and the patient is a human being, we don't want to minimize the pathology, but we want to establish a continuity in the working way, in the functioning of the many minds.
You know, I'd like to underline what you're saying, in particular, the issue of the length of treatment. It is a topic that people refer to. It's often referred to either jokingly, or it's referred to complainingly, or it's referred to as what an impossible task it is because it takes forever, that kind of thing. But you're bringing something else up that deserves to be heard, which is that it also offers us a deeper access to ourselves, because there are things that one could reach in the 10th year, just to pick a random number, that you mostly don't get access to in the 4th or 5th year, just to pick a random number. And that deeper access gives us access not just to ourselves, but also to reach and hold and even create that umbrella you refer to, despite at times torrential rains.
Yes, it's the protection of the analytic setting is something that the patient understands after a while, how helpful it is in order to progress in the analytic work and change. But at the beginning, it's something that can terrify the individual. Another possible comparison, an example, a metaphor could be that when you start familiarizing a child with the water, in the sea or in the swimming pool, one of the first exercises is to allow the child, or also an adult, if the adult is unable to swim, to, we say in Italy, I don't know if there is the same expression in English, to act as the dead person, which is...
Dead man's float kind of thing, yes.
Yes, which implies a couple of anti-instinctive movement. One is to let the ears go under the level of the water. People at the beginning react to this sensation as if it was something dangerous. And the other is that the body also is kept up, relying on the fact that the water will sustain you.
Right.
But this is something that is counter trend for the lying on the couch, more or less, requires for the same difficulty, because the patient can't control you. There are many patients that at the beginning of the analysis are sitting on the couch and controlling the analyst. And some analysts react by imposing to lie down, and some patients accept this, but some patients reject this and they leave. Today, for instance, I spoke with an experienced colleague who told me about some cases where he had to wait for some months before the patients could position like in the water and in a floating situation without controlling the analyst.
Right.
Maybe in the past, the patience of the analyst was lower than today, because today we can better understand some deep difficulties.
I'm going to ask you in a moment to represent the kind of patient that you have faced these issues with. But when you describe the swimming in the water and the counterintuitive permission one gives oneself, ironically, I was watching a stand-up comedy routine last evening, and the comedian who presented herself as somebody with a very, very difficult childhood and difficult symptomatology now, which she was able to present in a very humorous way, she described what it was like for her to try to learn to swim, and she couldn't learn to swim. She would fight it. She would grab onto people and push them down. She just struggled mightily. And then, as the vignette went, she saw somebody just floating on their back, very calmly going by. And she observed them, and she said, "Oh, that was a person whose parents cared whether they drowned or didn't drown." And it was said in a humorous way, but for our purposes, that's what it goes back to. It's that developmental history of trustworthiness.
Yes.
Tell us about not a real patient, but a composite patient who will show in your office this way.
Oh, yes. It's a very recent experience with a woman who came to my office by saying, "I want to start an analysis." But more or less like the fox of the Little Prince, she immediately clarified that I should have waited for some time, an undefined time, that she could exactly sit on the couch looking at me. And it was clear that it was in order to control me, maybe also to utilize a mirroring function, but not only. It was clear that she had to be safe regarding my face, what she could guess or explore in my expression. And I had to tolerate this temporary condition. It worked. It worked because step by step, some kind of familiarity began to be between the two of us. And after a couple of months, this person almost forgot her need to control and allowed herself to lie on the couch with some conscious satisfaction, exactly like a new beginner in the swimming pool, you would say. There is some similarity. And it was for me such a relief and so relaxing. And it was also a mutual perception that this allowed us to start a much more floating possibility to associate. In this case, it was not that big problem, but at the beginning, it seemed to be. With other patients, it has been more difficult.
When a patient comes, in contrast to this individual, and says, I want to start an analysis, and I'm prepared to start today 4 or 5 times a week and on the couch, and they do that, do you not also find with them sometimes that you're dealing with a counterphobic reaction?
Absolutely.
And that you have to work your way, just as with this patient, just a different style, to the point where they're really on the couch in an analysis? Yeah,
for sure. And this is one of those assimilations, projective assimilations of psychoanalysis.
All right, tell us about that. I love the phrase. and it's on my list of things to get to. Tell us what it means.
Yes, in short, psychoanalysis became also very popular, particularly among intellectuals or other categories, and it created a sort of false and too easy familiarity with the setting. While, as you described, there is a second step, which is much more difficult with these specific patients, because they act as the perfect patient.
Right, in quotes, right.
They are like in a movie, and right. They act. But in fact, a long time is needed before they become really spontaneous and in contact with deeper levels of their mind and the heart, I would say.
So you describe it in the book as saying this projective assimilation is really an effort to turn psychoanalysis into an everyday type of social therapy that, like you said earlier, doesn't involve newness, surprise, strangeness, discomfort, and all the progress that's potential in working your way through that.
Yes, it's a conformistic adjustment and adaptation, not at all. Now, when I spoke about today major sensitivity than in the past by the society, the community, the culture, and also the public institutions regarding psychoanalysis, I mentioned some macro phenomena like the assistance to children, the assistance to adolescents, a better sensitivity in the schools to detect difficulties of the of the students at the psychological and interpersonal level. The better understanding of the psychological difficulties in the hospitals, in the not only in the mental health services, but also in the general medical divisions. And there is a different culture that when is not affected by this hyper-cultural projective dilution, mm-hmm. I would say, it is a very a real changing factor yeah. in the contemporary culture.
You bring up society, and I want to return to what you wrote, which is the social function of psychoanalysis.
Yeah.
As you write, aimed at caring for social cultural clusters of the population who used to be excluded. What does that mean to you? How do you picture it operating in an ideal way or even in a practical way?
Beyond and besides all these highly developed countries where there is an effective mental health assistance, I mentioned, for instance, Middle and North Europe, where mm-hmm. The national health system provides the citizens with a number of free sessions of psychoanalysis paid by the state, by the national health system. But these are very special conditions due both to an economic good standing of these nations and a very advanced vision of the advantages of taking care of the psychic health, also in terms of general costs. But generally, also in the countries which are the majority, where there is no support for by the state and by insurances for an analytic help, the general mentality has developed. And this is one of the consequences of the Freudian presence in the world, when one says that Marx, Darwin, and Freud mm-hmm. were the three main factors that changed our lives. They are not the only ones, but it is true, because much more people today realize when another human being is in difficulty. Of course, a lot of factors contribute to this, but the fact that, for instance, in the schools, there is a higher level of awareness about these issues is a product of the analytic culture after a century, no matter. Otherwise, only drugs would be utilized, and today, fortunately, is not no longer the only way the disturbances, the psychic troubles are treated. Maybe I am a bit optimist about this. But,
well, perhaps, but you seem very naturally to return to that metaphor of the umbrella, to helping people in distress, which leads me in our closing minutes to invite you to share with the listener a bit about you. What brings you to be an analyst? What brings you to be the kind of analyst you are? Mm-hmm. And where you see you and the field going in the next while? I understand they're big questions, and feel free to handle them in any way that you're comfortable.
No, I feel quite at ease with this question, because one of the changes that analysis provided me with has been the awareness about how similar we all are. Of course, with the due differences, but For me, an analyst is, before all, a person who had the worth opportunity to realize how we all, the human beings, are very similar and how we can familiarize with ourselves and with the others thanks to these similarities and continuities. Like the majority of, but I would say like all my colleagues, I approached the psychoanalysis and I asked for analysis when I was a young doctor in order to be helped. And this is what is absolutely and seriously common to all the analysts. Analysts are people who are more aware and more experienced to ask for help than other people, and because they had the opportunity to be helped by a good treatment and to have the opportunity to integrate better their main areas, their levels, and to extend the opportunity to relate with others. The specificity of my personal condition, individual condition in my life, has been that I grew up in a large family. For several reasons, I grew up not only with my father, mother, and siblings, but also with uncles, aunts, grandparents. And I think that, for instance, this made more natural my interaction with our international psychoanalytic community, for instance. It was my use. But beside this, I want to repeat and underline that asking for help has been for each of us, I assume, the real starting point of our experience, training, and education. Yes, of course, there is also the scientific interest in abstract as an ideal, the admiration for the great explorers of the mind, Freud first, but then all the others. But I think that the first starting point has been our personal need. And this is the path we lead our patients to familiarize with. Not to feel ashamed, not to feel afraid of, but to utilize an opportunity.
Stefano, there's really nothing I can add to how you've just concluded our conversation. It is, number one, the words are lovely. Your spirit and tone is easily experienced, at least by this listener, as an umbrella of caring and protection and an effort to help. I think that will be many listeners' experience. And your combination of gentleness and thoughtfulness is very present, very important, and I'm grateful for it. So thank you. Thank you for agreeing to this conversation, for your work, and I'm appreciative of it.
Harry, I thank you because you made easy this interaction, this dialogue between the two of us. Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening. If I may, I'd like to ask you to help us publicize our podcast by rating us on iTunes or simply sharing it with a friend. You can also visit our webpage, ipaoffthecouch.org, where you can both subscribe and also add your comments. I'd also like to acknowledge the lovely rendition of Beethoven's Opus 18th String Quartet by the Allegri String Quartet on the Vivat label.